Section 1. America is a low-quality democracy. The low quality of American democracy reflects denial of majoritarian rule, an eventuality sought by many of America's wealthiest. Stout majority rule in other wealthy democracies has translated into larger government sectors funding an expansive array of public services. Alarmed by this powerful post-war evolution, a number of conservative American billionaires have contrived in recent decades to deny voter sovereignty and rule by majority. Their names, tactics, and strategies have been extensively documented by researchers such as Jane Meyer, Nancy McLean, Kim Phillips Fine, and Stephen M. Tellis. The chapters in this section examine how they have exploited Supreme Court rulings embracing pay-to-play to achieve success. Their tawdry accomplishment is measured in the redirection upward of the gains from growth since the Reagan administration, leaving wages stagnant and lowering opportunity while darkening hopes and the American dream for most. Chapter 1. Their accomplishment is documented by the income bias. Chapter 2, resulting from their exploitation of pay-to-play. Chapter 3, centered on the successful suborning of the Republican Party. Chapter 4. Chapter 1. Faux Democracy. America's Decline to History's Dismal Default Setting. American economic inequality has followed through to political inequality, and democratic government is bereft of power and capacity. Stein Ringen, Oxford Professor Emeritus, 2014. The main question confronting us today is not really about capitalism in the 21st century. It is about democracy in the 21st century. Joseph Stiglitz, The Great Divide. The hollowing out of middle-income households is a U.S.-only phenomenon. The Financial Times, December 2016. Political decisions determine who receives the fruits of capitalism. High-quality democracies spread those fruits broadly. The low quality of American democracy is at the heart of America's middle and working class economic stagnation. Flat wages and rising income disparity are eroding the spirit of community, enthusiasm, and optimism, just as they did during the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt affirmed that necessitous men are not free. A majority of Americans believe the American dream is dead. The U.S. economy has been misfiring for most Americans for over a generation. Wages have been flat, millions of quality jobs exported, and economic mobility has declined. The decline in economic opportunity is so pronounced that the phenomenon is common fodder for leading European newspapers. The Financial Times, in August 2017, for instance, headlined, "Five charts show why millennials are worse off than their parents." Indeed, 54% of U.S. respondents to the 2013 Economic Values Survey cited by Brookings Institution economists believe the American dream of opportunity as originally defined by James Truslow Adams is dead. Hard work and determination are no guarantee of success. Their pessimism is fact-based. Upward mobility for youths has fallen sharply since the 1980s. Some 92% of Americans born during the 1940s, for instance, earned more than their parents in inflation-adjusted or real dollars. Fewer than half of those born in the 1980s have done as well. With wages today scarcely better for most people than earned by their parents, optimism about the future has rightly suffered. Surveys document that decades of wage stagnation have caused Americans to grow pessimistic about the future for their children. Only 21% of respondents to a Wall Street Journal NBC News survey in 2014 believed their children would live better, a record low in polling. The share stood at 54% in 1980, before Ronald Reagan launched today's era of inequality. Some workers have realized higher wages, but an overwhelming majority has suffered stagnant or real wage declines. Even many of the better educated younger workers today earn no more than did younger workers with less education in 1980. And overall, census data show that the real median income of young workers aged 25 to 34 was 5.5% lower in 2016, $35,000, than in 1975, $37,000. True, household incomes rose until 1999, but that reflected women working longer hours. Since then, overall family incomes have fallen. As documented in an analysis prepared for the National Bureau of Economic Research in April 2017, weak wages have caused lifetime earnings for an entire generation of Americans to flatline or fall. And no improvement is expected by the authors of this authoritative analysis. Partial life cycle profiles of income observed for cohorts that are currently in the labor market indicate that the stagnation of lifetime incomes is unlikely to reverse. Since Ronald Reagan, birth status has come to dictate life's opportunities for too many, hardening American social classes. Importantly, despite 8 years of a Democratic White House, the ability of labor unions to raise wages has been the weakest since the 1920s. Economists at the International Monetary Fund have concluded that this factor alone is responsible for about one-half of the erosion in net U.S. income equality between 1980 and 2010. Dwindling opportunity and flat wages explain why two-thirds of respondents to a public religion research institute survey in 2015 believed that one of the big problems in this country is that we don't give everyone an equal chance in life. The ensuing despair has bled into the social fabric for Americans of modest means, who are experiencing rising opiate abuse and suicide rates and falling marriage rates. Wage rates and economic mobility, here and abroad. In contrast to America, voter sovereignty translates to economic policies that create prosperous middle-class societies in higher-quality democracies. The outcome is that economic mobility is more robust there, with youths readily earning more than their parents did at the same age. Their superior performance begins at an early age with abundant public prenatal care, expansive child care, early pre-kindergarten quality health care, and inexpensive quality education, kindergarten through college. Investment and job upskilling is higher as well, causing workforce skill levels in Northern Europe and Australia to now exceed those of the United States. Unsurprisingly, productivity levels in nations such as Belgium, Denmark, and France now surpass America's. The beneficence of these policies for low and middle-income cohorts is exemplified by Germany. Real wages there, at lower income levels, rose steadily during the 1990s at more than 1% annually, even outpacing earnings growth at the top of the income scale. That trend slowed during the 2007 economic crisis, but real wage growth at low and middle income levels has since returned to the long-term trend of around 1% per year. How do the real earnings of lower wage workers in Germany and across Western Europe keep pace with income growth at the middle and top? German economists explain, "This development is also likely a result of changes linked to the collective bargaining policy. In the hospitality sector, for example, an industry with particularly low wages, collective agreement wages increased between 2010 and 2015 by 16.7% in the East and 9.9% in the West. Although not all employees are subject to a collective bargaining agreement, the tariff increases may have also had an influence on the wages of companies that were not bound by the agreement. Trade unions were increasingly successful in claiming and enforcing sectoral widespread collective agreements." The contrast with America is dramatic. Hourly pay, adjusted for inflation in Germany, has increased nearly 30% since 1985. Labor compensation as a share of national income has actually increased in Germany since the 2007 recession, rising from 47.6% to nearly 51%. And the gains continue today. In fact, the average 2.5% real wage gains reported by the Federal Statistics Office for German workers in 2015 alone matched the cumulative rise in median real American weekly wages between 1979 and 2015. More broadly, real wages rose an average of 1.4% in the 28 European Union EU countries in 2015 and 1.7% in 2016. These steady gains have enabled real salaries abroad adjusted for purchasing power to leapfrog American wages. In the capstone manufacturing sectors in 11 wealthy democracies, wages and benefits are now more than $10 per hour higher than in the United States, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Service sector wages have risen steadily at nearly the same pace. Even so, despite notably higher wages, higher quality democracies outcompete America. Germany is the most competitive economy on earth. Its manufacturing sector is robust, wages are high and rising, and unemployment in 2016 was at a 25-year low. Similar outcomes are commonplace across Western Europe, where GDP grew faster in 2016 than in America, despite their higher wages. Burger King employees in Denmark earn $20 per hour versus $9 in the United States, receive 5 weeks paid vacation, overtime bonus pay, national health insurance, paid maternity and paternity leave, and have a pension plan. This striking contrast between falling American and rising Western European economic opportunity and wage performance is reinforced by international economic mobility statistics. They measure how readily males in various nations can improve their economic situation through education and diligence. At this writing, the most recent assessment is from May 2016 by Miles Korak of the University of Ottawa, published by the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. He and his colleagues concluded that America has devolved into a low-mobility society, where parental status is increasingly the determinant of lifetime economic prospects. Intergenerational earnings mobility of Americans is lower than in every nation of Northern Europe. American economic mobility is just one half that of Australia and Canada. The anemic rewards from education and hard work for American men is little better than for contemporaries in Chile or Argentina, where widespread wage stagnation and rising inequality also chill economic opportunity. Higher wages also mean the quality of life for most families in Northern Europe is superior, with secure retirements, longer vacations, and necessities such as quality public education, childcare, college, and healthcare more broadly available and affordable. Specific economic policies enacted in response to middle-class demands are responsible for the success of these countries and for their higher economic mobility, especially policies linking wage increases to rising productivity. That linkage is the black box behind their success in widely broadcasting rising incomes. Economic outcomes similar to Europe today were commonplace in America during the post-World War II decades, ending only with the arrival of the Reagan era and pay-to-play. Between 1947 and 1972, real wages in America rose steadily with improving productivity, which increased 97% over this period, while real median pay rose 95%. This post-war boom temporarily created history's greatest middle class, now eclipsed by Northern Europe. Many men and women could control their own economic futures in an opportunity society where striving frequently produced a secure and rewarding life for college and high school graduates alike. By 1968, income disparities were the lowest in American history, as measured by a standard used by economists, the Gini coefficient. During this era, real wages rose because lawmakers both heard and heeded popular sentiment for rising family prosperity, creating a high-quality American democracy. Labor unions and economic growth, here and abroad. Northern European lawmakers and citizens view labor unions as existential allies in the struggle to fend off the default setting of capitalism. In contrast, too many Americans, particularly billionaires, GOP lawmakers, and the Republican majority on the Supreme Court, reject labor unions and their role as antibiotics for the inequalities that are woven into capitalism's DNA. Unions are the backbone of the Northern European model of dynamic economies with robust social protections that deliver steady real income growth up and down the income ladder. This union-friendly mindset, reflected in public policies, is why corporations in Northern Europe widely broadcast prosperity. Wages there rise faster than inflation, roughly in line with productivity growth. Collective bargaining is why the bottom 90% of workers across Western Europe and in Oceania have received a far greater share of the gains from economic growth than have Americans since the Reagan era. See Chart 1.1. For example, the bottom 90% of Danish employees have received 90% of all income growth between 1976 and 2007, while during the same period, the bottom 90% of Americans received only 18%. As concluded by the Financial Times in December 2016, after examining the wealthy democracies, the hollowing out of middle-income households is a U.S.-only phenomenon. Comparing American and European work effort. Unemployment rates are higher in some EU nations than the United States, but that primarily is an artifact reflecting the millions of discouraged Americans who no longer are counted in the labor force. In Europe, by contrast, higher wages encourage men and women to work. Indeed, Americans find it startling to learn that more Europeans than Americans work. Specifically, a higher proportion of both European men and women, 25 to 54 years old, the cohort central to middle-class family prosperity, work than their counterparts in America. The data from the U.S. Council of Economic Advisers is unequivocal. Some 12% of 25 to 54-year-old American men were neither seeking work nor employed in 2014, for instance. That figure was only 7% in France and Spain and 4% in Japan. Higher European workforce participation translates to fewer of the pathologies unfortunately growing common in the United States, such as addiction and suicide, explored by Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone, as well as by Angus Deaton, Ann Case, and other sociologists. Importantly, the International Monetary Fund has concluded that the strong collective bargaining institutions, co-determination, and other practices responsible for steadily rising wages in other wealthy democracies like Germany are costless. They do not slow productivity or GDP growth. The Reagan administration launched the age of political and economic inequality. Today's age of rising political and economic inequality was ushered in by the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan. An analysis by the Economic Policy Institute found that 70% of all income growth from 1935 to 1980 went to the bottom 90% of households, while 7% went to the top 1%. Since 1980, however, real wages have barely risen, despite per capita production rising 80%, with the top 1% garnering 72% of all income growth. By receiving much of new income growth, the share flowing to the 1% grew to exceed 22% of all national income in 2012, compared to 11% in 1944. Former American Central Bank Federal Reserve Chairman and conservative Ben Bernanke notes that the wage stagnation, declining economic mobility, and the weaker workforce participation of our era reflects a failure of public policy beginning with Reagan. The Reagan Revolution heralded a more constrained approach to economic policy. Bernanke explains the ideological errors and omissions of Reagan were repeated by both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, which failed to expand job training and retraining opportunities, especially for the less educated, to provide transition assistance for displaced workers, including support for internal migration, to mitigate residential and educational segregation, and increase the access of those left behind to employment and educational opportunities, to promote community redevelopment through grants, infrastructure construction, and other means, and to address serious social ills through addiction programs, criminal justice reform, and the like. The outcome of Bernanke's Reagan Revolution, ending the steady post-war rise of real wages, has created a second Gilded Age. The original 19th century version was described by the American Populist Party platform of 1892. The fruits of the toil of millions are boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes for a few, unprecedented in the history of mankind, and the possessors of those, in turn, despise the republic and endanger liberty. From the same prolific womb of governmental injustice, we breed the two great classes, tramps and millionaires. Other wealthy democracies have continued to broadcast income growth widely since the 1980s because their citizens have retained political leverage. Their voters are sovereign. An example of this is the minimum wage. Unlike the United States, the proportion of low-wage workers in Germany, for instance, is stable. That is because, also unlike the situation in the United States, rising poverty induced the German government to institute a nationwide minimum wage and to increase it regularly to 10 euro per hour in 2017. In contrast, the Reagan Revolution ushered in decades of stagnant wages. The real minimum wage has declined. Job offshoring, widespread acceptance of greed in corporate executive suites, a spread in employment contracts containing non-compete and mandatory arbitration clauses, and a surge of independent contracting. Weaker unions are a key factor in U.S. wage stagnation, and the combination of pay-to-play and hostility to collective bargaining has caused the share of union jobs to be the smallest since 1916, a 100-year low. The American middle class is paying a high price for weaker unions. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that union members had annual earnings of about $49,000 in 2013, compared to $38,600 for comparable non-union workers. Certainly, rapid technology change and globalization have contributed a bit to wage stagnation, but the continued growth of real wages in Northern Europe affirms that the policies of Reaganomics are primarily responsible for U.S. wage stagnation. After all, the high-wage economies of Northern Europe experienced the same technology transformation as America in recent decades. Moreover, they are even more involved in international trade, yet real wages there have continued to increase. The most important reason is that voters, not political donors, are sovereign. Their political architecture favors majoritarian rule. Pay-to-play is explicitly rejected, as reviewed in detail in Chapter 10. Lawmakers have naturally responded to satisfy those sovereigns. They have installed works councils in corporations, employee groups performing the equivalent of mid-management duties in U.S. firms. Shareholder approval, say on pay, for CEO and director compensation levels, and importantly, co-determination to reform corporate governance. Co-determination requires that employees sit on corporate boards of larger domestic firms in order to ensure a middle class rather than an elitist firm mission. Those laws are sweeping, applicable also to foreign investors. For instance, the $200 million invested by American private equity firm KKR in the Nuremberg-based GFK in April 2017 included the appointment of three new corporate board members. They displaced existing shareholder representatives, leaving the original power of employees' representatives unaffected. Employee representatives on corporate boards would upgrade governance at American firms. Employee representatives naturally focus on long-term prosperity, which results in greater investment, R&D, and higher wages. That different focus is a major reason that corporate prosperity in Northern Europe translates to family prosperity. To put it in Aristotelian terms, their political systems produce more equitable economic outcomes because their landless are kings. That is not America, and foreign observers know it. Exemplified by German journalist Mark Huyar, writing in Der Spiegel. During the last few decades, America has been a country in which the rich have become richer and the poor poorer, and in which the middle class seems to be disappearing, and with it, the sense that everyone shares in rising prosperity. And here is former Australian Treasurer Wayne Swan, quoted in the Brisbane Times. "Don't let what has happened to the American economy happen here. Don't let Australia become a down-under version of New Jersey, where the people and communities whose skills are no longer in demand get thrown on the scrap heap of life." In Australia, Canada, and Northern Europe, the policy preferences of a majority of citizens are implemented by responsive lawmakers. The sovereignty of voters is responsible for their superior economic performance, with income disparities far smaller than in the United States. Indeed, the United States has the most severe income disparity of any wealthy democracy, more skewed than Greece or Portugal, and comparable to that of authoritarian Turkey. America's shrinking middle class. The median weekly wage of a full-time American worker in the all-encompassing non-farm business sector in 2016 was a bare 3.3%, $11, higher than in 1979 after adjusting for inflation. This stagnation began in the 1980s and has been exacerbated by today's gig economy, where many employee-employer relationships are impersonal and transactional. The number of non-standard jobs, temporary, on-call, independent contractor gigs, or workers supplied by outside contractors, has risen 70% since 2006 to 24 million, now comprising one in six jobs. They are popular with employers, enabling them to dodge benefit and other employee costs such as Social Security or Medicare taxes. Thus, non-standard translates to lower wages, 7% less for janitors, 14% less for educators, up to 24% less for security guards, and 9% less in retailing, according to economists. Combine that with job offshoring, weak labor unions, and the migration of jobs to the non-union American South, and the consequence is new American jobs that are disproportionately insecure and low wage. Indeed, Harvard economist Lawrence F. Katz and Alan B. Krueger of Princeton have concluded that a whopping 94% of employment growth since 2007 has been in non-standard categories. Data show that new jobs created in recent decades have consistently paid less than the old ones they replaced. More than 40% of the 8.5 million jobs lost in 2008 and 2009, for instance, had median wages above $20 an hour. But only 30% of jobs created through February 2014 were comparable. The International Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, has concluded that the United States has the largest share of low-wage jobs of any wealthy democracy. The outcome of Reaganomics is exemplified by the average wage of $12 per hour in America's largest employer, Walmart. In contrast, the average pay at General Motors, America's largest employer in the 1960s, was $35 an hour in today's dollars. These trends have reduced the American middle class, as documented by the Pew Research Organization. According to an April 2016 analysis, the share of American adults between 2000 and 2014 living in middle-income households declined in 203 of 229 metropolitan areas examined. And a Pew study 1 year later found that the share of American adults living in middle-income households dropped nearly 5% between 1991 and 2010. Contrary to the views of conservatives at the American Enterprise Institute and elsewhere, households falling out of the middle class account for most of that decline. Americans know it. A detailed Pew survey in 2014, see chart 1.2, found for the first time ever that the share of Americans who consider themselves below middle class nearly equaled the share self-identifying as middle class. 1 in 6 Americans who considered themselves middle class in 2008 have since fallen out, causing a 40% jump in the share of Americans who self-classify as below middle income. Moreover, the ranks of those who consider themselves above middle income, not shown, have also declined from 22% in 2008 to 16% in 2014. This subjective assessment is supported by objective international data. America now has the smallest middle class of any wealthy democracy, using global OECD standards. Measured by the share of households with disposable incomes between one-half and twice the national average, America's middle class is smaller than every nation in Western Europe and even Russia. It is comparable to the size of Uruguay and is scarcely larger than in developing nations, with notably skewed income distributions such as Egypt, Mexico, Brazil, and South Africa. Beginning in the Reagan presidency, the income garnered by the top 5% of American households grew faster than in every other democracy, while the income accruing to the middle class grew the least. That has caused America to drop near the bottom of wealthy democracies in providing equal economic opportunities. In 2011, for instance, the German Bertelsmann Foundation ranked America 28th of the 31 highest income democracies, providing less economic opportunity than considerably less affluent nations such as Ireland, Poland, Portugal, and Slovakia. It only ranked ahead of Chile, Mexico, and Turkey, nations with far lower per capita incomes and weak investments in education and other public goods integral to upward mobility. Notably, these other low-opportunity nations share the U.S. pay-to-play political systems, and thus are low-quality democracies. In a separate analysis 3 years later, in 2014, officials with the United Nations Development Program also placed the United States only 28th in its prominent inequality-adjusted Human Development Index, measuring citizen overall well-being. Low-quality American democracy, as described by Aristotle. The market economies of Aristotle's day intrigued him with their promise of expanding prosperity, and he devoted considerable attention to the pivotal role that politics play in determining market outcomes. He observed that over time, markets produce economic inequality and a class of predatory elites he termed oligarchs. Unless corralled, they deploy their economic power to subvert the political process, inevitably leading to a reduction in the quality of democracy and, in turn, more severe economic inequality. So powerful was this insight that Aristotle made it his measure of the quality of democracy. As noted earlier, his key test was the extent to which preferences of the landless are reflected in policy outcomes. What differentiates oligarchy and democracy is wealth, or the lack of it. The essential point is that where the possession of political power is due to the possession of economic power or wealth, whether the number of persons be large or small, that is oligarchy. And where the unpropertied class have power, that is democracy. Aristotle's Politics and Humanist Ethics explored this theme and were inspirations to political revolutionaries of the 17th and 18th centuries, including Thomas Hobbes, Thomas Jefferson, and John Locke. And his seminal principle linking democracy and economic outcomes has been repeatedly affirmed in America since the colonial era. Drawing on experience during the Gilded Age, for instance, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis concluded that Americans may have democracy or may have political power concentrated in the hands of a few, but can't have both. In recent years, econometricians have explored the Aristotelian theme in unprecedented detail. Using gigantic digitalized statistical bases, they have developed a data-rich understanding of the economic character and historic evolution of cultures. Economist Daron Acemoglu of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and James Robinson of Harvard document that past societies have rarely been uplifting for the 99%, virtually always subject to relentless predation by elites. In Why Nations Fail, they conclude that political elites always connive to extract economic surplus, and economic elites always connive to control politics. Thus, de facto indentured men, women, and children dehumanized as prey, analogized to beasts of burden and tribal others, have been a large proportion of nearly all societies throughout history. There were only four relatively brief epochs before the political revolutions beginning in 17th century Europe, where the grip of elites was considerably, if temporarily, eased, and innovative, entrepreneurial new men could emerge. In the ancient Greek city-states, beginning with Corinth, Republican Rome prior to Caesar, the 13th century Venetian Republic, and the handful of innovative textile centers that emerged in 15th and 16th century Europe in circumstances conducive to entrepreneurship. The quality of politics determines economic outcomes. Like Aristotle, Acemoglu and Robinson conclude that the political nature of a society is the major determinant of how the gains from growth are allocated. They and others, such as historian Yuval Harari, explain that the default setting of history is for predatory, exclusive, economic, and political systems to go hand in hand. Periods of high-quality democracy, as in post-war America until the 1980s, or Europe today, are rare and tenuous. They are continuously under threat from Aristotelian oligarchs, as noted by Oxford professor Stein Ringen. Democracy is not the default. It is a form of government that must be created with determination and that will disintegrate unless nurtured. Political and economic equality are unnatural states, achieved and sustained only through a relentless, vigorous struggle against long odds, as summarized by OECD officials. Equitable societies with large middle classes are not the natural outcome of market forces. Equity, rather, is created by society, by institutions, the laws, policies, and practices that govern the society, its economy, and in particular, its labor markets. Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz notes that elites design the rules of the game to ensure this outcome, that is, through politics. The Greeks called this plutocratic bias of market economies diaplachy, the consequence of an incestuous relationship between powerful economic and political actors. Martin Wolf of the Financial Times explains, "This outcome is rule by affluent vested interests, or quite simply, plutocracy." In the modern era, this predatory, extractive default setting began to give way only in the wake of the remarkable 17th century revolutions in politics and the later revolution in technology, when James Watt had perhaps the single most transformative scientific insight in human history. Compressed steam pushes back. More equitable income distributions and expanding middle classes began to emerge on the heels of political tumult, as political revolutions in Britain and Europe slowly gained traction. Most notably, the British Glorious Revolution of 1688 affirmed the principle that legislatures, rather than monarchs, rest at the center of governance. This transition was neither peaceful nor linear. Instead, achieved as a consequence of revolution, regicide, Great Depression, or war. As inclusive or pluralistic governing systems with diffused political power emerged, popular pressure for the development of more inclusive economic systems featuring social safety nets and labor rights grew. In America, Acemoglu and Robinson note that rising suffrage produced a gradual virtuous circle of political and then social and economic reforms. The political changes were unmistakably toward more inclusive political institutions, and were the result of demands from empowered masses. The capstone democracy model that emerged only slowly across Western Europe, Britain, Oceania, and North America is a fragile, historical aberration from the natural state of mankind. Creating political equality. Countries such as America that desire greater economic equality must first craft institutions that promote and sustain political equality. The post-World War II governments of nations such as Denmark and Germany created high-quality democracies featuring political equality and voter sovereignty. The ensuing public policies created opportunity societies characterized by strong wage growth, universal health care, collective bargaining, quality daycare, stakeholder corporate governance, quality schools, routine job upskilling, inexpensive higher education, and the like. Co-determination and high-quality democracy. High-quality democracies diffuse economic gains and increase economic opportunity with policies that link de facto growth in real wages to labor productivity growth. The institution at the center of this process is co-determination. By requiring that employees sit on corporate boards of larger domestic firms, co-determination ensures a middle-class corporate culture. It is a culture that is also focused on long-term firm prosperity, rising real wages, and little, if any, job offshoring. It's a concept that is 60 years old and has been adopted by 19 of the 27 EU nations, not counting the departing UK. In Germany, for instance, employees occupy half of the seats on boards of directors at the 600 largest firms. The prowess of co-determination is affirmed by the German economic performance. Its impact on job offshoring was documented in October 2016 by the international consulting firm EY, Ernst & Young, using data from the blue-chip firms comprising Germany's DAX 30 stock index. The study period was 2011 to 2015. These firms are global household names, such as Adidas, BMW, Daimler, and Merck, all with co-determination governance systems. EY analysts found that the increase in sales made abroad, either exports or produced abroad, by these firms, 28%, considerably exceeded their creation of foreign jobs, 8%. The difference was satisfied by adding jobs at home to produce exports. That explains why German employment increased at these huge firms domestically by a greater amount than their rise in domestic sales. This outcome reflects the impact of employees sitting on these corporate boards, attentive to long-term firm prosperity, investment, as well as expanding domestic employment. These policies are the precise opposite of policies pursued by many larger American firms, who grow by offshoring higher-wage U.S. jobs to low-wage nations. For example, a Wall Street Journal analysis by David Wessel, covering the period from 2000 to 2009, found that American multinational firms eliminated a net of 2.9 million domestic jobs, while adding a net of 2.4 million jobs abroad. A second study by Martin A. Sullivan on behalf of the nonpartisan Tax Analysts think tank confirmed that data. It found that U.S. multinationals cut a net 1.9 million domestic jobs during this period, while adding a net 2.35 million jobs abroad. The lesson: co-determination prevents job offshoring. It ensures that corporate job growth occurs at home rather than in low-wage nations abroad. Handelsblatt editor Frank Specht quotes German President Joachim Gauck as describing co-determination as an important cultural asset because of its centrality to middle-class prosperity and capitalism. American ignorance of co-determination. The responsiveness of lawmakers to voter preferences explains why higher-quality democracies achieve steadily rising real wages. Laws and institutions, such as those in Germany, produce outcomes that are the antithesis of American-style wage suppression. Yet Americans are simply unaware that the Northern European variant of capitalism produces larger and more affluent middle classes, with superior future prospects as well. European economists, such as Thomas Piketty, regularly explore the profile and dynamics of these superior-performing democracies and their economies. but his American counterparts are mostly mum. Progressive American economists, many liberal organizations, and mainstream media economic journalists have kept American voters in the dark. No public shaming, but you know who you are. Only a handful of American industry and labor experts write about the superior living standards in Northern Europe, including Scott N. Paul, writing in the New York Times in December 2016. We're not Germany, with its high wage, high export, and stable manufacturing sector. But only rarely are the higher living standards of middle-class Europeans and their greater workforce participation even noted in the U.S. media. Few economic journalists and academic economists in the United States are informed about works councils and co-determination, with exceptions such as Olivier Blanchard at MIT, born in France, Larry Favre at the University of Tennessee, Michael Furst at the University of Miami, and Barry Eichengreen at the University of California, Berkeley. It is ironic that the most thorough analysis, clarifying that shareholders in co-determination firms earn higher returns than shareholders in firms lacking co-determination, has been conducted by two American economists, Favre and Furst. Low-quality American democracy, the income bias. Stagnant wages since the Reagan Revolution signal that American democracy is of lower quality than in Northern Europe, with U.S. policy outcomes reflecting the preferences of higher-income Americans, producing what political scientists call the income bias. Surveys reveal that voters realize their votes are outweighed by donors, including respondents to the November 2015 survey, noted earlier, by the Public Religion Research Institute. Some 64%, for example, believe their vote does not matter because of the influence that wealthy individuals and big corporations have on the electoral process. Some 79%, including 63% of Republicans, believe American capitalism unfairly favors the wealthy. Only 5% believe the government looks after the interests of the middle class. Americans also realize that the income bias has grown more severe of late. Pew polling in 2015 found that 76% of Americans believe money has a greater influence on politics and elected officials today than in the past. Only 22% see little difference. And 74% believe that elected officials don't care what people like me think. That figure is up from 55% in 2000. Four factors are primarily responsible for the income bias. The first is the corporate culture that emerged during the Reagan presidency, drawing on the narcissistic free market philosophy of the Russian emigre and atheist Alisa Rosenbaum, Ayn Rand. This culture embraces Rand's rational selfishness philosophy, urging corporate officials to set aside biblical teachings in favor of their own pecuniary self-interest. The Randian Revolution marked abandonment by executive suites of the post-war model of stakeholder capitalism, in which corporations had been managed to benefit employees and local communities as well as shareholders. It demonized the collective bargaining responsible for high wages and prioritized behaviors designed to facilitate the seizure of windfalls by senior executives armed with stock options. Share buybacks, uneconomical leveraged buyouts or mergers, and corporate inversions are other manifestations of this syndrome. Stock options became widespread, with executive remuneration tied to next quarter's earnings per share. The consequence was a sharp focus by CEOs on self-aggrandizement attained by raising short-term quarterly profits, achieved by allowing cash flow to fall to the bottom line, cash flow that had previously been devoted instead to R&D, wages, and investment. The reduction of corporate cash flowing to investments in order to show greater current income explains why privately held firms, where CEOs are tightly monitored, invest at a stunning 2.5 times the rate of public U.S. companies, 10% of assets versus 4%. A second factor contributing to the income bias is a willingness of wealthy conservatives to aggressively invest in politicians in order to further their philosophy of small government. They have donated and spent billions of dollars on the GOP to further their agenda of boosting profits through wage suppression, deregulation, and greater market concentration, while also seeking to lower taxes at the expense of spending on public R&D, innovation, education, and the like. A third factor is a transformation of the Republican Party in the early 1990s that was initiated by then-Congressman Tom DeLay and Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. DeLay believed that accumulating political power necessitated an expansive pandering by the GOP to affluent donors, especially corporate interests and wealthy, staunch conservatives. Gingrich, as quoted by E.J. Dionne Jr., explained to Republicans, "You're fighting a war. It's a war for power." Fourth is the decriminalization of political bribery that marks the Buckley pay-to-play era since 1976, to be discussed in chapters 3 and 8. The Supreme Court ruling in Buckley v. Valeo and similar decisions, including Citizens United, has transformed the currency of American democracy to, well, currency rather than votes. These four factors explain why numerous lawmakers have come to favor the agenda of donors rather than the preferences of the broader public, with a profound impact on the quality of American democracy. As quoted in the New York Times, Trevor Potter, a former Republican member of the Federal Election Commission, admits, "It just takes a random billionaire to change a race and maybe change the country." Acemoglu and Robinson explained that inclusive institutions can also reverse course and become more extractive because of challenges during critical junctures. Two such critical junctures were President Nixon's four Supreme Court appointees, responsible for the original Buckley ruling, followed more than a decade later by the three Simpatico appointees by Ronald Reagan. America's economic inequality comes from the political inequality ushered in by the era of pay-to-play and the other three factors. As noted earlier, Piketty describes this ideology as producing an endless inegalitarian spiral, portraying the decades since Reagan this way. We subsequently see a rapid rise in inequality in the 1980s, until by 2000, we have returned to a 1910 to 1930 level on the order of 45 to 50% of national income flowing to the top 10%. The magnitude of the change is impressive, an unprecedented explosion of very elevated incomes. The egalitarian pioneer ideal has faded into oblivion, and the new world may be on the verge of becoming the old Europe of the 21st century's globalized economy. This theme is also reflected in numerous recent works by other economists, including Robert Reich and Joseph Stiglitz. Recall that Aristotle's test of the degree of democracy is the extent to which the economically powerful are constrained, with preferences of the landless reflected in policy outcomes. As we see next, Aristotle's maxim in the context of the U.S. economy is the precise question that political scientists Martin Gellens and Benjamin Page set out to test in their pathbreaking 2014 research that has convincingly documented the income bias.